everybody. How are you doing today? I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. This is a pre-recorded program for a number of reasons. One, on Tuesday, when this program is airing, May 28th, it's my partner Gary DeMattei's birthday, and we're going to be out and about celebrating all day long, so I won't be able to do the program. Also, because of the move at Progressive Radio Network, there aren't any live programs being recorded at this moment, so I couldn't do it anyway. But rather than air an older program, a previously recorded program, I wanted to give you something new, something fresh. And my guest today has a new film that's premiering later in the week, so I wanted to get this information to you right away. So let's get right to it. I would like to bring on my guest, Richard Myron. He assistant edited Oscar-nominated Life Animated, as well as Art and Craft. He was the lead editor for the recent feature documentary, The Surrounding Game, available on Netflix. He received his BA in art from Yale University, where he won the Howard Lamar Prize, Yale's top film award. Myron was, for 2 years, the director of programming for the Environmental Film Festival at Yale and has a background in animal rights. He received the Marcy Bloom Fellowship in Film and was a fellow in the 2016 IFP Documentary Labs. And Richard is here with me today to talk about a new award-winning film, For the Birds. Welcome to It's All About Food.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So I watched For the Birds, which is about 90 minutes. We're talking about it today because it will be playing in cinemas in New York City and in Los Angeles, and we'll give some details about that in a moment. And I wanted everyone to know about it. What I'm excited about today is being able to ask you questions, because the film really posed a lot of questions, and I kind of want to tap your brain about that. I just watched the Broadway show Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. We won the lottery, and we were able to see the two-part show, and we got buttons that say "Keep the Secrets." So I'm not going to divulge what happens. No spoiler alerts in this show, because I think it's important to watch the film, and because there are twists and turns and it gets exciting. So I'm not going to spoil anything here, but I will ask you some questions. Great. So the first question is, why did you make this film?
So this film began when I was a senior in college at Yale. I had become a vegan around my sophomore year, and I just got really interested in animal rights and animal rights philosophy and just rescues and sanctuaries. And I, at the same time, was getting into documentary filmmaking. And so I thought for my senior year project, I would make a film about animal rescue and try to film it from multiple perspectives, because the kinds of films I was most interested in were the ones where you kind of empathized with people you didn't expect to empathize with, and where you kind of feel like you're inside the moral dilemmas of the characters. So I volunteered at the Woodstock Farm Sanctuary for just a few days during my winter break when I was a senior, and I was just looking for a story, and I got to meet all the animals and the caregivers, and I happened to be there when they first heard about Kathy and her birds. And all I'd heard was that there were, you know, between 1 and 200 ducks, chickens, geese, and turkeys on this property in Wawarsing, which was about an hour away. And so I just hopped in the car with Sheila, who was the shelter manager at the time, and we just went and visited Kathy for the first time, and I brought my camera with me, and I, you know, met Kathy, and she was really warm and welcoming, and the situation was a bit confusing, She really loved her animals, but there were too many, and Sheila, you know, saw, you know, a lot of problems. And so I just, you know, felt, you know, I asked Kathy whether I could film, and she was happy to be on camera. And I just realized that this was a complex situation, and I wanted to follow it. So that's kind of how it got started. And then I just kept going back to film more.
Well, I was fascinated because you were there pretty much at the beginning. I know there was some earlier footage that probably came from Kathy's family that you showed, mm-hmm. but the story, you really started at the beginning, and I thought, how did you know to start this story before you even knew what the ending was?
Yeah. I mean, I really was in the right place at the right time. And, you know, in terms of storytelling, this kind of was the inciting incident for what would, you know, spiral the rest of the story, which was, you know, the sanctuary visited Kathy and saw the situation. And then, you know, they were trying to get some birds off her hands, and the tension kind of kept building from there. So, I was very fortunate to be there when I was there, and be able to watch it unfold.
I'm also curious about people that are okay being filmed, especially when things get mm-hmm. tense. Mm-hmm. And you said that Kathy was fine with you filming. Did it ever change where she didn't want you to film, or she was happy that you were documenting the story as it unfolded?
Yeah, I think for everybody, they were okay with me filming for most of the time. It's a really delicate set of relationships. You know, it's like consent to be filmed is an ongoing question. It's not, I never forced anyone to be filmed or assumed that it was okay. It was, you know, I made sure to develop relationships with everybody independently and try to not judge anybody. And I think that was, you know, part of what, you know, Kathy saw in me, and she allowed me kind of into her space and into her life because she saw that I was genuinely curious about her as a person, to understand the greater context of her life. And the same went for the sanctuary. I mean, they knew I was a vegan. They knew that I cared about animals, and it was just kind of moving from one person to another and making sure that I kind of was keeping these relationships in good health. So it was hard. It definitely got harder and harder as the story kept going because there was more and more conflict that was arising. But I, you know, tried to kind of stay as neutral as I could in order to keep that access to everybody.
I was just talking with Isa Leshko, a photographer who has a new book out about aging animals, and the photography is amazing. But one of the things that we talked about was not being able to get signed, what do you call them? The notices.
Oh, a release?
There we go. Not being able to get the release form from the animals. Yeah, and she made a big effort to be respectful of the animals, kind of reading whether they were comfortable or not with her being there and with her being there with the camera. Mm-hmm. And once again, you know, you weren't able to get release forms from all of those birds. Mm-hmm. How do you think they felt about being where they were on Kathy's property?
I don't know that I can answer that question. I mean, I think that, and I don't want to pretend to try. I think that we try to project and understand what an animal's thinking, but it's hard. You know, I think like something I thought about a lot throughout the course of making this film was what happiness is and kind of levels of happiness, you know, because, you know, for example, like a duck who's never been on a pond, how do they know what they're missing, you know?
Right.
For, like until they get to the ponds. And that's kind of, I find to be kind of an endlessly fascinating question, you know, for people as well. Like, how do you know if there's a greater happiness out there that you could have if you're kind of, if you've gotten used to the confines that you're already in? I definitely like thought about the idea of happiness and what makes a life fulfilling. I thought about that across the humans and the animals in this story while filming.
But we don't really know who the good guys are and who the bad guys are. It's rather gray because everybody brings compelling points to their story, but there were laws that Kathy was apparently breaking. Maybe she wasn't aware of it or whatever. But I kept thinking of a bigger picture where we have how many billion animals, 60 billion land animals a year are killed for food, and they're kept, most of them, in horrific conditions in factory farms. And right. And a lot of it's legal.
Yeah.
And those were some of the questions that were coming up to me where, you know, I could understand the events that were happening in the film, but at the same, in the bigger picture, it's like, why isn't this happening all over?
Wait, why is what happening?
Well, yeah. Why isn't the law there to protect?
Oh yeah,
the
yeah.
birds in factory farms—they're not protected at all in terms right. of sentient beings.
Right, right.
So there's some kind of hypocrisy yeah. going on in the laws that we have that might protect a particular community about having too many animals living on a property versus in a factory.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, and I think it has to do with labeling certain animals as agriculture animals and not as pets or as, you know, dogs and cats are protected. Yeah, I mean, that bigger question was certainly on my mind too, and also on the sanctuary's mind. What was interesting for the sanctuary is that they can't, as you said, like, you know, it's not illegal what's going on in these factory farms, or it's not enforced. And so it's, you know, I mean, you can't just go to a factory farm and call the SPCA and say, there's cruelty to animals happening here. Can we, you know, get a search warrant and like, and so the sanctuary saw that with Kathy's situation, they were able to help these animals, more so than they were able to help the animals a few miles away in a factory farm. And so it's definitely a huge irony that exists kind of in the background of the film, I think. And, you know, for Kathy, you know, she saw herself as an animal advocate as well, and, you know, felt like she was doing, you know, a good thing for her animals, and also is a vegan. She became a vegan over the course of filming and was already a vegetarian. And so she kind of saw herself on the same side and as the sanctuary. And it was a very interesting world to be filming in, where kind of everybody technically cares about animals, but is in conflict with each other. And yet there's like, you know, billions of other animals, you know, that are not being cared about at all out there. So, yeah, I don't know the answer to that question, but it's certainly a question I had too.
Well, that's what I appreciate about this film, because I believe as an artist should be asking questions or making us question what we perceive as normal or okay, and questioning the way things are. You don't have to provide the answers, but you start, yeah. Start the conversation. And we have right. lots of films coming out. I remember when I first became a vegan, which was 31 years ago, there really weren't any films. There was one. There was Diet for New America with John Robbins, and it was a great mm-hmm. film. But it took a long time before technology made it a lot easier for more people to be in the right place at the right time and start filming and enable a lot of us to view these things. But most of the stories kind of assume one side and lead us along. They're the good guys and the bad guys. And I mean, I enjoy a lot of them, but some people just totally disagree and just don't want to have anything to do with the film. But this, that's what I appreciated about For the Birds, that you were showing all sides and with a degree of respect and where we can understand how complicated life is.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, there was something I learned in a documentary class I took in school. I may have read this in one of the books we had, and it was that right versus wrong is not as interesting as right versus right. And so to, you know, to use that as a principle in storytelling to say, like, can we justify, or can each character justify what they're doing and also be in conflict? And, you know, if we're wrestling with, I mean, I kind of call it like empathetic tension, because I think that's kind of like what I felt while filming, where I, you know, would spend time with one person and kind of see, oh, I see your point, you know. And then I go to the next one and I'm like, oh, I see your point. And then suddenly you kind of have this swirl of like people and animals that you care about. And yet the situation is such a mess. So I really wanted to take the audience on that same journey where they could kind of feel that tension inside of them of, you know, caring for somebody, but also disagreeing with them at times, that kind of thing.
You may not know the answer to this question, but I'm just wondering, after seeing the film, how many farm sanctuaries get involved in legal cases doing something that the other party doesn't think is fair and ends up suing?
Or
fighting.
Yeah. I don't know how frequent it is, but I don't think it's that frequent, because I don't think that sanctuaries want to get involved in legal cases.
No, I don't think they could afford it.
Yeah, certainly the SPCA didn't want that to happen either. I think it was a surprise for everybody, including me, that Kathy ended up having a lawyer come on her side and push back, because that had never happened for the SPCA in a situation like this. So. Mm. So it became, it was about a 9-month legal battle, because Kathy's lawyer, you know, fought back. I don't think that was an ideal situation for anyone really. It's kind of rare It made the film more interesting.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It made the film very interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, so now let's talk about where people can see this. I understand there's an event coming up in New York City at IFC Center, May 31st to June 6th.
Yeah. It'll be running, for those 7 days, 5 times a day, I believe. So people can see it.
And,
you know, whenever they want. And
there'll be a Q&A opening night, something like that?
This Friday night and Saturday night at the primetime showings, we'll have a Q&A with myself and my co-producer and co-editor, Jeffrey Starr, and our executive producer, Brian Reed, who made the podcast S-Town, which some people may be familiar with. So he's going to be moderating a discussion with Jeffrey and me, and then we'll have, you know, question and answers afterwards. That'll be opening weekend.
Okay, then you go over to Los Angeles to the Lem. How do you pronounce this?
The Lemley Monica Film Center in Santa Monica.
Very good, and that's on June 10th.
June 14th.
Oh, June 14th.
Sorry.
Oh, yeah. I have two different things here. Okay.
Oh. The tickets will go on sale on June 10th.
Oh, that's right. Okay, so the tickets go on sale May 27th for New York's IFC Center and June 10th for the Lemley Monica Film Center. Great. Yeah. And after this, the film will be available for streaming in July?
Yeah, at the end of July, we'll be launching on digital platforms. And then, so people will be able to stream it in any English-speaking country, I believe, most English-speaking territories. Yeah.
Well, it's a great film to have at events because, like I said before, it really starts a conversation.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah. It's been quite a journey. We've been at 20 film festivals, and the conversations with the audiences afterwards are amazing. People really have a lot of questions and are left thinking for weeks, they tell me. So it's
that's great. Were there any particular comments or questions that were surprising or profound to you?
I don't know. A lot of them are about the plot. I mean, and about how it got started.
Yeah, that was the most fascinating part to me. How was it? You were there, right? The right place at the right time.
Yeah,
and do you have anything coming up other than promoting this film? Any other right place at the right time films you're working on?
Not yet. I'm working as an editor on other documentaries right now until I have a spark of inspiration for my next project.
So okay. So before
I'll keep you posted.
Before we go, I just wanted to ask you, why did you go vegan?
Yeah, great question. I had become a vegetarian when I was 9 or 10 years old. And I was one of those kids who, as soon as I really realized what I was eating, I got really disgusted by it. And I just told my parents I wasn't eating it anymore. I became vegetarian and then was that way until college. And then when I was in college, I knew a guy who was a vegan was just like, I would have dinner in the dining hall and kind of see his plate like full of colorful vegetables and like, you know, everything that I don't know, is nutritious and healthy and like aesthetically pleasing. And I just asked him one day when we were eating dinner, I said, okay, like, tell me why I should be vegan. I was just in that place of like, I'm ready to open my mind if you give it to me straight. And he did. And he, you know, he just kind of within 2 minutes, he kind of described factory farms for eggs and dairy as just as bad or worse than the meat industry, and described it as essentially slavery for these animals. And I was just really moved by that argument. And then I said to him, okay, I'm going to try being vegan tomorrow. And I went home that night and then I just was Googling everything and watching all these videos and just in complete shock at what I had kind of pushed away for years and years. And so it was kind of a rabbit hole of truth that I just couldn't avoid anymore. And from that point onward, I've been vegan. So I've been vegan about 10 years now.
Thank you.
It was the best choice of my life.
Yes, thank you. I think that's one of the reasons why For the Birds is also an important film, because people find it hard to understand that dairy cows and chickens are probably more abused than animals we raise for flesh. The end result for all of them is slaughter, which isn't pleasant, but it's the journey to slaughter, and dairy cows and chickens that lay eggs specifically are just drained of life from as soon as they're born to produce until they no longer can, and then they're slaughtered. And there are so many of them. And many people give up red meat and go to chicken. And then the chickens that are raised for their flesh are also, I mean, it's just a disaster. And people need to know that.
Yeah.
They need to know this information. And we need to think more about birds, that they're intelligent and they're kind and caring and have feelings. And thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, Richard Myron, thanks for joining me today on It's All About Food, and I wish you the very best with the premieres of your film in New York City and in LA and with future screenings, and I look forward to see what else you come up with in the future.
Thank you so much, Karen.
Okay, take care. That was Richard Myron, everybody, and I really recommend when you have a chance to see For the Birds. It's a very provocative film, and it's only 90 minutes. Now the big news this week is Beyond Meat. The Beyond Burger by Beyond Meat Inc. has been around for a while now, and a number of stores, Whole Foods, and restaurants like TGIF and a number of others have been introducing the Beyond Meat Burger. I've mentioned it many, many times on this program. So you may be aware that the Beyond Meat company went public just this week. And the plan was to introduce the shares. The initial public offering was $25 a share. And then it went to $65, a little over $65 on the first day. And this was the best performing first day IPO in nearly two decades. And I just checked and the shares are now at about $80 a share. This is incredible. It's incredible because it's a vegan product. And I have voiced my concern about products like Beyond Meat. I've asked myself many times why the Beyond Meat company, the Beyond Burger, along with the Impossible Burger, have become so popular when there have been numerous other kinds of plant meat options available for a long time, some of them for centuries. Truly centuries, because there have been Buddhist monks who have been making some incredible plant meats for a very long time. Why did these particular products become so popular? And why did Beyond Meat become the best performing first day IPO in nearly 20 years? This is really incredible. So I want to believe that this is a really positive thing, that people want to reduce the meat in their diet because they realize it's horrifically cruel to raise meat, to raise animals for food. And many people are realizing the impact of meat, animal agriculture on climate change. And people, I'm sure, are concerned about their own personal health. And all of these reasons are being expressed in the sales of these products. And I've expressed my concern numerous times because Beyond Meat Burger is not necessarily a healthy food. Now, maybe people who are going from eating a burger, a beef burger, to a Beyond Burger may have some improvement in health because the Beyond Burger doesn't have cholesterol. It does have fiber. But if you're familiar with the ingredients, has anybody read the ingredients? I know I've read them a few times on this program. Water, pea protein isolate, expeller pressed canola oil, refined coconut oil, and then cellulose from bamboo, methyl cellulose, potato starch, natural flavor, maltodextrin, yeast extract, salt, sunflower oil, vegetable glycerin, dried yeast, gum arabic, citrus extract, ascorbic acid, beet juice extract, acetic acid, succinic acid, modified food starch, and annatto. Does this sound like food to you? it's fascinating to me how it is that so many people out there are impressed with this product and are buying this product. And it's flying off the shelves in Whole Foods in many, many places. And nobody seems to care what's in it. And it's just mind-boggling to me. I guess for folks that have been eating animal flesh for a long time and haven't really perhaps thought about what it is, moving to a similar product that isn't made from animals and acknowledging the impact that raising animals for food has on climate and health and cruelty, that this seems a no-brainer. It seems like an easy switch. But why is it that many people are not concerned about what their food is made of? It's mind-boggling to me. Do you have the answer? Are you concerned? Well, you're listening to this program, so I know you're interested in food. But it's fascinating to me. Is it just the marketing behind these products, that they're so well marketed that people are interested in buying them? Or is it just the taste and people are just concerned about taste? I'm asking these questions because I don't know the answers. It's fascinating to me. Now, Gary and I, this week in celebrating Gary's birthday, which we're doing for a couple of weeks, everybody should celebrate their birthday for a long time. Every day should be a celebration. And I'm always looking for reasons to celebrate. So right now we're celebrating Gary's birthday and going out a little more often to restaurants. And we've been to a number of our favorite vegan Chinese restaurants that offer meat alternatives. And some of them are amazing. And yet they're just not marketed to the mainstream world. And it just blows my mind. So while we're celebrating the Beyond Meat Incorporated initial public offering and the great success that they're having and the fact that people want to eat plant-based burgers, specifically the kind that tastes like meat, I just want to review those ingredients that I read before. Expeller pressed canola oil. Now, in my world, I use organic canola oil. And there are many people that have read about the problems with canola oil. And if you are concerned about canola oil, I suggest that if you want to use an oil when cooking food and you want something that withstands heat, I do recommend organic canola oil. I also recommend not using oil very often, using it sparingly. But the concern with canola oil is with conventional industrial oil, and that's important to know. If you want to know more, I can send you some information. You know where to find me. I'm at info@realmeals.org. Because a lot of people, when I mention using canola oil, they're like, what? I've heard all these horrible things about canola oil. And that is true of industrial canola, not true of organic. And then the next ingredient is refined coconut oil. And I don't know how many questions I've received about canola oil because so many are promoting canola oil as a health food and a superfood and a food to prevent Alzheimer's. All of that is a myth. And coconut oil is another food that's yummy and delicious, but isn't really good for us. It contains a lot of saturated fat. And that's one of the main ingredients in this burger. The main ingredients are water, pea protein isolate, the canola oil, and the coconut oil. So it's oil and protein. And that protein is a manufactured, highly industrialized product made from a simple pea, which is good for you. It's a legume. But then it goes through a lot of hoops, a lot of processing to make the pea protein isolate. And we don't really have a lot of information about how good for us it is to consume pea protein isolate. And then we have cellulose, maltodextrin, which isn't really good for us, potato starch. None of these are whole foods. This is not a whole food product. Except maybe the beet juice extract, but it is an extract, and we have to be concerned about extracts because that can also be a highly manufactured food. I was also reading some posts on Facebook by some folks that I know that are vegan that were celebrating the Just Egg product. And I know I've read the ingredients of the Just Egg product on this program before, but I'm going to read it again. Just Egg contains water, mung bean protein isolate, expeller pressed canola oil, and then it says it contains less than 2% of dehydrated onion, gel and gum, natural carrot extractives for color, natural flavors, natural turmeric extractives for color, potassium citrate, salt, soy lecithin, sugar, tapioca syrup, tetrasodium pyrophosphate, transglutaminase, nisin, a preservative. Again, this is not a whole food. It's not a healthy food. For those people that want to have an egg-like product, like an omelet, and don't want the cruelty of using eggs from factory-farmed eggs, don't want the cholesterol and all the other ingredients that a real egg from a chicken will contain that aren't really good for us, many would think trying the Just Egg product is a good thing. But we really need to read the labels. So I'm just kind of curious if there was like a machine to jump into the future to see what it would look like consuming a lot of these manufactured food products on health. Is it better than eating the animal products? I'm not saying I want people to eat animal products, not at all. But what I would really, in my world, I would like to see people moving from eating animal foods to eating whole, minimally processed foods. But apparently that's tough for Americans and for other people around the world. And that just confuses me. I'm going to move on to another subject. I recently had my annual exam with my dermatologist, and I recommend everyone getting a regular checkup to have the entire body checked for possible problems with the skin that might lead to different types of cancer. And there are parts of our bodies that aren't really easy for us to see. So it really makes sense to have a medical doctor check on an annual basis, I think, is a good idea. And I had my checkup recently. And actually, it was a nurse who looked at me first. And what the nurse said to me was my skin looked dry. And she wanted my skin to look shiny, which I thought was interesting because when I look at people's skin, it doesn't normally look shiny. So I'm not exactly sure what she meant. But I told her I'd put coconut oil on my skin. And if you know me, you know that I like to use products on my skin that I can eat. Because the skin, which is the largest organ, absorbs whatever we put on it. And I don't want to put any strange ingredients on my skin that I wouldn't eat. So I like to use food. And coconut oil seemed to be a good thing. But she told me that the body doesn't really absorb coconut very well, and it's not good for a moisturizer. Did you know that? And then I thought, okay, what am I going to use? And I thought about cocoa butter. So I have now switched to cocoa butter. And I've made my own cream where I add a little coconut oil to the cocoa butter so that the cocoa butter goes on more easily. Have you tried cocoa butter as a moisturizer? It's delicious. I love smelling like chocolate. So this is my new skin cream product. And I'd love to hear from any of you if you use cocoa butter or similar products. Now coconut oil I still use as a makeup remover. And I might use a little bit on my hair. But I've now moved over to cocoa butter. And I've also used shea butter, which is also a a hard fat at room temperature, so it's better if it's mixed with some other oils or products that will help it be more like a cream rather than solid. But something I found is that the shea butter will go rancid. It starts to smell funky if I don't keep it refrigerated, and it's not really convenient to keep a product like that in the refrigerator. Well, something I read about cocoa butter is that it's one of the most stable fats known, containing natural antioxidants that prevent rancidity and give it a storage life of 2 to 5 years. Now, I don't plan on keeping a small container of cocoa butter for 2 to 5 years. I believe in using all food products. When you get them, you use them and don't let them linger. But it's really nice to know that it's not likely to go rancid very quickly. Now, here's a question for you. Do you drink vitamin water? I have to admit, I have never purchased a bottle of vitamin water, and I'm not recommending it here. I'm not recommending it for a number of reasons. Number one, we really should avoid drinking beverages from plastic bottles. Plastic is a disaster for the environment, and making beverages in plastic bottles uses far more water and resources than the actual liquid that's in the bottle. And as you know, these bottles are devastating on the environment. They don't degrade very easily into putting it back into the environment into something useful. They fill up landfills. And when they're in a warm or hot environment, the plastic can leach toxins right into the beverage. And also, we should be getting our vitamins from whole, minimally processed foods, and perhaps supplementing a few that are recommended, like B12, vitamin D, K2, zinc, maybe some vitamin C, but we really don't need to be supplementing lots of vitamins. And I wouldn't want to get my vitamins supplemented from a beverage where I don't know how much I'm getting. You could figure it out by the quantity that you're drinking in the bottle, but it's best to supplement from a controlled amount in a pill and not by drinking it, and maybe you're drinking it in numerous different bottles. Anyway, why am I talking about vitamin water? Because I have come up with my own vitamin water that I really dig, and I want to suggest it to you. So if you ever cook vegetables, steam them or boil them, the water that remains has vitamins in it. The water that remains that you used to cook with has nutrients in it and really shouldn't be wasted. So there's lots of different things you can do with that vitamin water. Certainly you can use it to make a vegetable broth. If you're into making vegetable broths by saving the little carrot tops that you don't use and celery and pieces of onion, or just making one fresh, you can add that water to your vegetable broth. But something that I did recently, which I thought was really fun, I steamed some cabbage leaves, red cabbage leaves, and I was pouring off the water and looking at it and saying, this is a gorgeous color. It's a lovely purpley pink. So I saved it, and I had it the next morning for a nice beverage. And I've frozen these cubes of ginger juice and lemon juice recently when I was making my vegetable juice. I think I mentioned it last week or the week before. I made separate juices. I made ginger juice and stored it separately in lemon juice with the rind separately and carrot juice. And then I made a green juice and celery juice, and I stored them each separately. But the ginger juice and the lemon juice, I put them in ice cube trays, and now I have little ice cubes of concentrated ginger or concentrated lemon, which are fun and colorful to put in drinks. So I put a lemon juice cube in my pink red cabbage water. It was great. So that is my vitamin water, and I recommend it highly. And you can do that with so many different vegetables. Some people might think I'm nutty, and I don't care. But if I steam broccoli, for example, or cauliflower, I like to save that water because it's so, so nutritious. And you may have read some of the articles by Dr. Michael Greger where he talks about the best ways of cooking. Is it steaming or microwaving? And I think in some instances he actually said the nutrients are preserved best in microwaving. And I'm not about to use a microwave because I don't like them. I'm not convinced that they're safe, and I just don't like preparing foods with a microwave. It's not the kind of artistic thing or quality thing I like. It's quick, and I've used them in hotels, but I don't own one at home. Anyway, I think that the comparison of different cooking techniques wasn't exactly thorough in that if you're cooking vegetables in water, which is a great thing because it's the temperature is controlled and they don't get too hot. If you consider that you're not going to consume the liquid that the vegetable is cooking in, then you're going to lose some nutrients and it won't look like as healthy way to cook. But if you do consume the liquid, then it's ideal. That's why Dr. Furman recommends consuming a lot of soups and stews, because the vegetables are controlled at a low temperature, low compared to cooking in oil or baking. And because when you're cooking in water, the rules of chemistry apply. So water boils at 212 degrees Fahrenheit, 100 degrees centigrade at atmospheric pressure. And when you're cooking in water, you can't go higher than that, because as you reach that temperature, the water boils and then it'll change into steam, but it won't get hotter until all of the water is gone, and then you're going to burn your pot, which I have done. But that's a different story. It's beneficial to cook in water to control the temperature that way. When we bake something, which we can bake something at 250, 300, 350 degrees Fahrenheit and higher, there's the possibility of creating acrylamides. Acrylamides are not healthy for us. They've been shown to increase cancer risk. And cooking in oil will also enable the heat to go to higher temperatures, which can cause carcinogenic products, which is why we like to cook in water, because it controls the temperature and keeps it at a safe low temperature. But my point here is not to lose the nutrients in those wonderful vegetables. So make your vitamin water. The last thing I wanted to talk about today was an update on my friend Bilal Kizilbash's new product, Easy Kale. Has anybody tried to purchase this product since I talked about it last month? I'm very excited and I'm very proud of what Bilal has been doing. To begin with, the demand is great and they're sold out currently. So they will be working on increasing production and making it more available for people. And this is fantastic. And the other thing is, out of the entire United States, 200 of the most innovative companies get to represent the country at the Global Entrepreneurship Summit, which is taking place in the Netherlands shortly this year. And Bilal's company, Easy Kale, was selected to be one of those companies. And it's really, really exciting. So I'm happy to share that update with you. And I hope you do get to try Easy Kale, especially if you're someone who doesn't like to eat kale. This is a great way. If you remember, one tablespoon of this product, this powder, equals 4 cups of fresh kale. Now, I have to say, I love kale, and I would much prefer to eat kale as a salad or steamed. It gives me a lot of joy to eat kale. If you're not someone who likes to eat kale, it's pretty much like any food. It's something that you can grow accustomed to. And kale is one of these bitter greens. And we have been trained, our taste buds have been trained to like oil, sugar, and salt, and not really to identify the bitter flavors in foods. Personally, when I was going through my cancer journey about 12 years ago, and I knew that the dark leafy green vegetables were so important, and I wanted to avoid really sugary foods at the time, even fruit juices, I trained my taste buds very quickly. I started consuming lots of green juice, and I didn't love it in the beginning, I will confess, but I trained myself quickly because I was on a mission. I was on a mission to get well and to heal and to live. And I learned to love the flavor. I find that adding lemon juice or ginger juice really helps, and mixing with celery juice. You get all the benefits of all the nutrients, the minerals from the celery and the flavonoids from the lemon rind, and all of that is really good, but it helps improve the flavor of the kale. Although I could just eat kale raw, kale juice raw, and steamed kale. I love it. So if you want to like kale or any other food that you particularly don't like, just eat a small amount on a regular basis. I think it helps familiarize the tongue with a flavor. And there's also a psychological component. So when you're eating foods that are good for you and you want to enjoy them more, the things you think about while you're eating them need to be positive. Like, this is a food that is going to love me back. This is a food that's going to nourish me. This is a food I want to get to know better. If you're giving yourself the negative vibes while consuming a new healthy food, like, oh my God, this is so disgusting, I can't possibly consume it, it's going to be a lot harder to learn to love that food. And I really encourage you to learn to love the foods that love you back. I love talking about that. And perhaps we'll continue this conversation in the next program, Learning to Love the Foods That Love You Back. It's a talk that I like to give and will only give you benefit all around. Thanks for listening to It's All About Food today. I'm Karen Hartglass. Remember, have a delicious week.